From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with comedian Richard Belzer. Also today, I talk with Peter Grushkin, whose new book, The Art of Rock, is a visual history of rock and roll concert posters. Rock critic Ken Tucker gives his picks for the best albums of the year, and film critic Stephen Schiff runs down the best and worst films of 1987. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Richard Belzer made his reputation as an abrasive comic. Robin Williams once described him as the Marquis de Sade as a game show host. Now Belzer's stand-up act is laced with political humor, parodies of rock stars, and autobiographical stories. Belzer got his first big break acting in the video and film versions of The Groove Tube. In the early days of Saturday Night Live, he warmed up the audience before the broadcast started. Then he graduated to guest star shots. After his regular appearances on the late-night TV show Thick of the Night, he got his own cable show, Hot Properties. He's done several cable comedy specials, and he'll be starring in two forthcoming movies. Richard Belzer is in New York to laugh in the new year in a show at the Felt Forum. I spoke with him from the NPR Bureau in New York before his New Year's Eve show, and I asked him what it's like to deal with the crazy audiences on New Year's Eve.
Well, anytime you get any people drinking in an audience, being a nightclub comic, I have a lot of experience with that, they're going to be a little tilted. New Year's Eve exaggerates that quotient, so I expect that they'll be a little vociferous. But my rule is I'm never rarely on stage at midnight. I try to go on as early in the evening as possible before people are totally whacked out of their skulls and don't know what planet they're on. So it depends on what time you go on New Year's Eve.
You must be used to handling absolutely everything and anything. For 5 years in the mid-70s, you were the MC at Catch a Rising Star, comedy club. So you must have learned how to handle everything, including the craziest hecklers.
Yeah, well, when I first started, I didn't talk to the audience at all. I just introduced the acts. And then as time went on, I realized that I had to address the audience and asking people where they're from, what they're wearing, about who they're with. And it just kind of evolves, and sometimes you discover, sometimes I initiate it, and sometimes there are hecklers. So there are all different kinds of hecklers. Some people are very innocent, they just want to be a part of the show, and they think they're helping the comedian. Some people are mean-spirited drunks who want to disrupt the show. Some people are disruptive without even knowing it. I mean, it's just everything you could possibly imagine. Like relatives, I guess. Good analogy.
You said sometimes you would initiate it. How so?
Well, if I come out on stage, I don't usually like to start with prepared remarks. I usually just come out and say hello to the audience. And then if I see someone who looks interesting in the front row, a couple or a person, I'll ask them where they're from, and then I'll ask them what they do, and then I'll ask them all different kinds of questions to elicit responses, and then ad lib and improvise off of the information they give me.
You've seen a lot of bad comics perform.
Yes.
What are some of the mistakes you've seen them make that you've learned from?
Well, a lot of them make the mistake that I made when I first started, and that's to rush your material when you're not getting a laugh, to speed it up. And that's the death knell. That's the worst thing you can do, is to speed up the material. What I used to do, my fatal flaw, was I would get mad at the audience for not laughing, not thinking it was me. So I would get hostile towards the audience for not laughing, and it just kind of built into this trap that I would put myself in and had to kind of verbally dance my way out of. But I soon realized that the thing to do is to take your time and not rush the material. I'd say that's the number one rule.
When you were angry at the audience for not laughing, what would you say to them?
I can't say it on the radio.
That bad.
But that period in my career didn't last too long, though. That was just like a few weeks when I first started. I realized what I was doing, because I would tape my act. A big thing with comedians when I started, I hope they're doing it now, is recording your act every night, and then you could listen back to it and see where you rushed and see where you got the laughs and see what works and what doesn't, and it's invaluable.
Richard, can I ask you to move about an inch back from the microphone?
Okay.
Great. Thanks a lot. The peas are just popping a little
bit. Sorry. Well, I didn't realize it, but I thought the mic was in back of me. Mommy, could you move that mic for me? Thank you.
You've done a lot of television, and I'm going to ask you about what was, I'm sure, the most dramatic moment for you, which is when you were hosting Hot Properties and your guests were Hulk Hogan and Mr. T from WrestleMania.
The fascist twins.
Yeah. Well, you were nearly killed on that program.
I was. I'm glad you find that humorous. But no, it was one of the most bizarre events ever because I had them on the show. Someone on my staff said, we can get Mr. T and Hulk Hogan on the show. And I said, yeah, sure, right, great, because I'm not really a big wrestling fan. I was when I was a kid. When it was Antonio Rocca and Ricky Starr and the Graham Brothers. I don't know if you remember those people.
And Haystacks Calhoun.
Yeah, exactly. So then it was more theatrical and taken for what it was. These guys, for some reason, I think it's steroids, hardened the arteries of the brain, and fear of not being masculine because they pump themselves up. They become everything that they think they can do to become a man, and actually they're antithetical to men because they have to go around beating people up to prove they're men. So on my show, I met Hulk Hogan before the show. He was very nice to me. And during the show, for some reason, he got real crazy, and I asked him to demonstrate something on me. Now, I had Mark Breland, who's an Olympic boxer, on my show. We did a demonstration. He didn't actually punch me. I did a lot of different things on the show where no one ever actually physically attacked me. So that was the last thing in my mind. And for some reason, he took upon himself to knock me out in his arm. He kind of crushed my head until I couldn't breathe.
A stranglehold?
Yeah, and then it's called a front chin lock. And then he dropped me to the floor while I was unconscious. And I hit the back of my head on the floor and woke up in a few seconds, jumped to my feet and went to a commercial. And then I realized that there was Niagara Falls was pouring out of the back of my head. And then I went to the hospital and eight stitches. So now I'm suing him for $5 million.
When you were unconscious and you came to for a few seconds, did you really? I never saw this program. I never saw a tape of that particular show.
Right.
But when you came to, did you actually say, we'll be back after this?
Yes, I did. And my doctor was amazed because I was in shock at the time. And I just sprang to first of all, when I was unconscious, I had a dream. And I was only out for about eight or 10 seconds. I had a dream. I was dreaming that I was late for something, like, you know, the show or something. And little did I know, I was dying on the floor of the studio. So I sprung to my feet and I said, we'll be back after you know what, because I never say the word commercial. I always say we'll be back after this or message. So I had the temerity to do that. I guess show business was in my blood, only I didn't know it was going to be all over my jacket and the back of my head.
Did you think you were dying?
Well, he knocked me out so fast, it was very painful. He started squeezing my head, and I tried to signal him, but I couldn't even lift my arms. And then my brain said, check, please, because there was no oxygen going to my brain, so my brain wanted out. So my brain turned off, as brains do when you're being strangled.
I'm probably cynical enough so that if I was watching it at home, I would have thought, oh, I bet that was staged.
Well, the amazing thing is, one of the reasons I'm suing is because a lot of people thought it was staged. Many people could see that it was real. But a lot of people thought it was fake because wrestling, by definition, is fake. But I can assure you it was real, and I have the scar to prove it and the lawsuit to prove it. And it was just a grotesque anomaly in show business.
Did it affect your career at all?
I'm not allowed to talk about that.
I see. Okay. Right. Okay. Well, let me ask you about your life and how you got into comedy. Now, I know you grew up in a housing project.
Yes.
And I've read that you didn't have a lot of money when you were growing up.
No.
And I assume that you were one of the funny kids in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Was that a kind of protective shield for you, being funny? Did that mean that you weren't going to be picked on by the toughest kids around?
Well, it's interesting. My wit has saved me more than once. And I found when I was a kid that the tough guys, a lot of the tough guys in the school, liked my wit. So I would hang around with some tough guys, and we would come across some other people. And I would, like, put them down, and they'd go to beat me up, and my friends would beat them up. So I never really had to get in any fights, really. Because I would, like, kind of instigate a fight, and then Vinny or Rocco or Vito would do the rest.
Instigate through verbal abuse?
I sound like a little fascist, don't I?
Yes, you do.
But that's when I was a little, you know, I was young. It was 30 years ago. I was a young, skinny kid.
Now, you've said in one of your routines that when you were young, your mother used to beat you and that you would try to tell her jokes to get her to stop.
Right, right. Well, she was the toughest audience I ever had.
Yeah.
And my kitchen was the toughest room I ever worked.
Well, how true is that, though?
Actually, it's quite literally true. It didn't work as much as legend has it. But I when I was a kid, I had a crew cut, or a zip, what they called then, very short hair, and I looked just like Jerry Lewis. And I used to do a Jerry Lewis impression. And sometimes my mother would get mad at me, and I'd do my Jerry Lewis shtick, and she'd laugh and forget to hit me. But I'd say that worked maybe 2 times out of 20. So she usually wound up hitting me anyway. So the material wasn't that strong.
You know, one of the many old cliches is that humor comes from pain.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it sounds like it's actually kind of true in your life.
Literally and figuratively. But see, I subscribe to that theory to a point. I don't think that you can relegate a facility to be funny or any talent to a specific psychological situation. I think there has to be talent that is naturally intrinsic to the person. And then if there's a psychological situation that makes it come out. I mean, I don't think that every kid that was hit grew up to be a great boxer or a great,
great comedian. Yeah.
But I think there has to be something there, and the two work together.
I know exactly what you mean. Now, you've also said in your routines that you were thrown out of every school that you went to. Does that include college? Were you thrown
out of college? Yes, I was thrown out of college. It was funny because one of the reasons I was thrown out is because I led a demonstration in 1964. Before there were Vietnam War demonstrations, this was like the wimpiest demonstration. We wanted to have women be able to visit the boys' dorms or the boys visit the women's dorms, I forget. So I got all the guys in my dorm to like march over to the women's campus, you know, like clapping our hands, you know. And the security guard, his name was Joe, and we all knew him, he came over to the crowd, the mob, and he said, "All right, guys, come on, let's go, break it up." And we said, "Okay, Joe." And that was the demonstration. There was no bomb throwing. There was no Mario Savio. There was no...
For this, you got thrown out of college?
Well, that was on my record that, you know, I led a demonstration. I broke curfew. I, you know, had liquor in the dorm. You know, how bad can you be in 1964?
Right, right. Now, then you went into the Army.
Yes, and I was thrown out of the Army, too. Well, I was actually discharged under honorable conditions for being too funny to carry a gun. So wait a minute, this guy's too funny. He's too funny, which is almost true. Actually, I got out of the Army by feigning mental illness, if you will. I pretended that I was suicidal, and I staged this whole thing where I said I got beat up and my back was hurting, and they found out I was faking, and they sent me to the Jewish chaplain in the Army. I didn't know there were Jewish chaplains. I thought Pat O'Brien was the... I didn't know Jews joined the Army. I didn't know Jews were, let alone chaplains. And I went to this rabbi, and I said, "Rabbi," because my sergeant said that you know, you got to go see your chaplain, Belzer, because you need help. So I went to the chaplain. I said, "Chaplain, with all due respect, I think I need to see a psychiatrist." And he said, "You know, Freud was a Jew. And the reason he became a psychiatrist was to discover his Jewishness. You don't need a psychiatrist. You need to discover why you're a Jew." And he lectured me on kosher food and choirs, and how I could sing at the Army Jewish Choir and eat kosher food. And I said, "Really, Rabbi, I need to see a psychiatrist." He said, "You have to discuss. Do you have a girlfriend?" I said, "No." He said, "Did you ever have?" I said, "Yeah." "Was she Jewish?" "Good." Like, everything was revolved around Judaism, which was the farthest thing from my mind then. I just wanted to get out of the Army. Finally, I was allowed to go to the psychiatrist, and I, having had a little college, I knew every freshman psychology phobia. So I said that I went to bed, I was suicidal, I hated my mother, I was afraid of women. I just did every cliche in psychology, and I got out.
That's amazing.
I hope no one's listening.
That's probably
from
one
the
of
Pentagon.
Your, one of your most convincing performances.
Yeah, and I never do this on stage. Maybe I should tell them my Army story on stage.
It's pretty funny.
Yeah. There's a lot more. I mean, it's a 40-minute story. I'm really brutally paraphrasing the story.
Did you ever think to yourself, what happens if I'm discovered that this is just an act?
What's that?
When you were trying to get out of the Army and faking
all
this stuff.
Well, I think that it's kind of like partially, you know, they knew that I was acting crazy, but I was crazy to do that in the first. It was kind of like that, you know. It was like,
right, if you could do this so well, who wants you around
exactly.
anyways?
Exactly, it was like Kafka meets Catch-22 or something.
Comedian Richard Belzer is my guest. He's in New York for a New Year's Eve performance at the Felt Forum. We'll talk some more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Comedian Richard Belzer is my guest. No, you were talking about the chaplain in the army who lectured you about...
Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah, who lectured you about Judaism. I think the very first time I saw you perform was on Saturday Night Live, and you were doing your impression of Bob Dylan in, like, a retirement center, singing in a Yiddish accent.
Right, well, the 86-year-old Bob Dylan.
Yeah. Now, I hate to ask questions like, how did that idea come to you? But really, how did that idea come to you?
Well, when I was a kid, I hate to say that Bob is that much older than me, but, well, when I was a kid. When I was a teenager, and we started first getting into Bob Dylan, and we found out his real name is Zimmerman, and he's a Jew from Minnesota, and this was like a revelation to have a hero that's a Jew. So I said, if his name is Zimmerman, he must have had a bar mitzvah. So I fantasized what Bob Dylan's bar mitzvah must have been like, you know. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech olam, asher kiddushanu b'mitzvosav. And then when he gets older, you know, oi, once upon a time, you dressed so fine, you threw the bums a dime in your prime, didn't you? People called Shady Red Doll, you're bound to fall, you thought they was all kidding you. And so on.
Oh, who spoke Yiddish in your family?
Actually, I just got back into Yiddish music. I've discovered these things. Everyone in my family spoke Yiddish, but I resent the fact that they didn't teach me, they didn't teach my brother or my cousins. My parents would talk in Yiddish, my grandparents would talk in Yiddish, and there's a comedian who does a routine, I can't think of who it is, but where it's true, if I may borrow the routine without crediting the person. And that is that Jewish families had the habit, the adults would tell a joke. They'd be telling a joke in English, and then a kid would walk in the room, and then they do the punchline in Yiddish. They say, so the guy walks up to the maid, he opens the door, he sees that she has no clothes on, and then a kid walks in the room, and he goes, "Achal v'shin v'chel v'cha," and you don't know what the punchline is. It was the most frustrating thing I've ever... I still resent my uncles to this day for doing that to me. And I wish I could remember the comedian that did that. Maybe it was Robert Klein, but... That's not my routine, but it's a true story.
You know, since it was the older people in your family who spoke Yiddish, did you think that when you grew up, you'd automatically know the language?
That's funny, because I have a theory that everyone, when they get old, no matter what religion they are, they have a Jewish accent. Even Irish people, they get to be past 65. I want to go to the store now, because I'm in the store? Good, because I can't, hello? You know, everyone, Italians, everybody, they, for some reason, they get a Jewish accent. Don't ask me why.
Oh, gosh. earlier in your career, you were the comic that used to warm up the audiences for Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, I started doing that the first few shows, actually.
I didn't realize I'd even have a warm-up comic there. What kind of stuff did you have to do?
Well, it was kind of thrilling in those days to be a part of that because, you know, regardless of what anyone says, a lot of people didn't know how this was going to be accepted. This was like giving the kids the key to the store. To have all these, in quotes, anti-establishment people have a TV show on a network. And so they asked me to do some sketches and do the warm-ups. I just kind of did what I did in nightclubs. I talked to the audience. I did some of my material. But I tried to improvise and ad-lib as much as I could, asking people where they're from. And it was fascinating doing that in a television studio, not a nightclub. So it was an interesting situation to be in.
I know that in... 84, I think it was, you were diagnosed as having cancer, and you're over that through surgery.
Oh. Oh, my God.
You said in a magazine article that in a way that was a blessing in disguise. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think that when you feel the breeze from the wings of death, as I did, the more you feel how mortal you are. All the near-death cliches are true. It does change your life. You do look at things differently. You do value... people and events more, and I don't mean to be corny, but it's very true. And I think that I reordered my life as a result of that situation. And I mean, I don't recommend you go out and get cancer by any stretch of the imagination, but it's certainly not a totally negative situation. I mean, I was it's kind of hard to talk about. I mean, I was devastated by it, but it was also a very revelatory epiphany for me, if I may be Joycean for a second.
Do you think it changed your work as a comedian at all?
People say it has, but I feel I still have the same point of view. I have a very cynical point of view in terms of the world situation, and I think that comes through. I may seem less bitter now on stage, which is, I guess, in quotes, more commercial. But I'll let other people theorize about that.
My guest is comedian Richard Belzer. Now, I know you've just finished shooting a couple of movies
yes.
that you're co-starring in.
Yes.
One is called Freeway, and in that you play a radio psychologist, someone who takes questions from listeners. And,
you're on
and
the air.
Yeah, right.
What's your problem?
Now, did you understudy someone for that?
Well, I did do some I've done a lot of radio in my day.
But not as a psychologist.
No, not as a psychologist. The character is a Dr. David Lazarus. He's a psychiatrist who was a forensic psychiatrist in New York, and he moves to L.A. because he wants to get away from solving crimes in New York. And what I did was I listened to a lot of people, and then I went to the studio. Do you know who Dr. Toni Grant is?
She's in Los Angeles?
Yeah, she's out of L.A. She's on nationally, but she's out of L.A. And I went
I haven't heard it. What does she do?
She's kind of like a hipper, younger Dr. Ruth without an accent.
Uh-huh.
That's the first time I describe her that way, but that's exactly what she is. She's a very lovely woman, very bright, and very sweet with the callers, but sometimes she can be real tough. And she gets a lot of interesting people calling her up from all over the country with different problems. Like, I found out my husband's bisexual. Should I be worried about AIDS? I love this fat woman. And every time she loses weight, I get sexually excited when she puts weight. You know, questions that you could never write. Amazing questions. A guy who masturbated in a laundromat. And that's a call they screened. They didn't even take that. But my thing was, I watched the guy. There was a guy who screens her calls. He has a little computer terminal in front of him. And he says, "Hello, Dr. Toni Grant, what's your name? How old are you? Where are you calling from? What's your problem? What do you want to talk to the doctor about?" And if it's acceptable to their format, then he types in the question, and then she takes it on her end. So it's fascinating. And in a way, it's very, it's sad in a way, but then there's a solution to it, because there's a lot of people that need somebody to talk to. And I mean, a lot of people make fun of call-in shows, but when someone is sensitive on the other end, like Toni Grant, then it really serves a function. I know it's instant analysis and pop psychology, but people in this country, a lot of people need someone to talk to. It's a huge problem.
So you're playing a sympathetic character in this movie?
Well, it's interesting because I get to be sympathetic and I also get to be cynical. I have asides to my assistant and I get sarcastic a little bit, but there's some underlying thing in my character that shows that he's really a caring person, even though he has a cynical veneer.
You're used to performing mostly your own material in
mm-hmm.
stand-up,
right.
And now you're getting more into movies.
Right.
Do you ever have trouble performing somebody else's idea of funny?
That's a very good question. Fortunately, in these two films, both parts were written for me. So I've had the luxury of having characters that were based on my persona, or, you know, to a degree. I mean, the psychiatrist is not exactly who I am. But the director is a friend of mine and knew me and wrote me into the script. So I've been very lucky in these last two films, because I've been allowed to improvise certain material and certain things that I couldn't say. I hate to be a method actor, but some things you can't say. And I was very lucky. These guys were very acceptable to my notes. Sometimes we disagree, but, you know, usually they were right, so.
Now, you said that the films were written for your persona. Now, I don't think of you as a persona comic. Do you think of yourself as having a stage persona that's very different from who you are?
Not really. I mean, the older I get, I hate to say it, the older I get. I guess the older I get, the more I am like the person I am on stage. So the two are meeting. My offstage personality and my onstage personality are kind of converging. When I was younger, or years ago, I was much more, cynical and bitter on stage, and it carried over offstage, whereas now I think there's a nice balance. Did that make sense, that last?
Yeah. Okay. do you ever, you know, one of the problems nowadays is that special interests are so fragmented, and there's only a fairly narrow number of things that everybody knows in common, like the records everybody knows or the books everybody's read. Do you ever want to say something in one of your routines that you know you can't say because only like three people are going to get the joke?
Well, that's one of my jobs. I like to talk about esoteric things. I mean, not 90% of my act, but there are a lot of things in my act over the years that have been things that I've seen or read that is not open to the general public, or literary references, or things about science, or things about all different kinds of subjects that I feel compelled to talk about. And without being patronizing, sometimes I think I can educate the audience. And if I mention something that they never heard of, a literary reference or a line from a play or a new scientific discovery, then maybe they'll go and find out about it. So I'm not inhibited. I know a lot of comedians try to be as broad-based and as commercial and as accessible as possible and as least offensive as they can be. And for good or ill, I never subscribe to that theory.
Are you in stand-up for the long haul, or would you eventually like to get out of it and just go into acting?
You know, James Cagney, somebody once asked James Cagney what he would like to be remembered as, and he said a hoofer, because he was a dancer, and obviously he's one of the greatest actors in the history of film. I like to be remembered as a stand-up comic, or thought of as a stand-up comic, even though I'm very interested in acting in films and doing radio and records and some music things, but I'm basically a stand-up comedian, and proud of it.
Good.
Because there's a lot of people demean the occupation, but I think... And particularly in times like these, the comedy really serves a valuable function.
Why now more than any other time?
Because I think we're in... Reagan has put a false veneer on this country that we're going to wake up from like a bad dream. And it's going to be very... We're in for some very rough times in this country, economically, racially, politically, militarily. And I think that the multitude of comedians will serve their function well, the way films did in the 30s during the Depression. I think comedy will fill that void of uncertainty and fear.
Are you watching all the candidates now to see who's going to get elected and who you'll end up doing impressions of once they get into office?
Well, I'm afraid that George Bush is going to run this country into the ground. I'm watching it very closely, and I'm afraid that that George Bush is going to be our next president, as much as I hate to say that, because Americans are very insecure and very lazy, and they know his name. They know he's had this job, something called the vice president, so he must know something about it. That's why Reagan, you know, Reagan is like the father, the kind of dumb father figure who never spanks his kids that we kind of like and apologize for and are not really afraid of, even though he's incompetent.
You follow the news very closely for your comedy.
Yeah. Well, I used to be a newspaper reporter, so I follow the news, and it just winds up that I use it in my act, but I'm obsessed with the news. I would be anyway. I'd probably be a newspaper reporter if I wasn't a comedian.
Well, Richard Belzer, I want to thank you very much for talking with us, and I wish you a very happy New Year.
Thank you. You too.
My guest has been comic Richard Belzer. He spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in New York. He's in New York for a performance New Year's Eve at the Felt Forum. He has a starring role in the forthcoming films The Wrong Guys and Freeway. And in July, he has a new book out titled How to Be a Stand-Up Comic. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Bruce Chatwin, who has traveled around the world and written about it in such books as In Patagonia and The Songlines. I hope you can join us, and I wish you a very happy New Year.
Once upon a time, you dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you, people call, say, beware, doll, you're bound to fall. You thought
funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner, designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, a talk with Paul Grushkin. He edited a book on the art of rock and roll concert posters, from the birth of rock and roll to punk. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker and film critic Stephen Schiff give their respective picks and pans for 1987. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson in Washington. Drugs may have been involved in the shooting deaths of three men and the wounding of two others late yesterday in New Hampshire. The gunman, Rafael Rodriguez, was later shot to death by police. The shootings occurred in Nashua and Londonderry. Nashua Police Chief William Quigley says he's not sure about the motive.
I don't know at this time. I don't know what triggered this at this time. The only reason I say we suspect it's drug-related is because of the knowledge we have of the suspect involved.
Quigley would not detail Rodriguez's past criminal record. He said no drugs were found on Rodriguez or any of the victims. Authorities in Algona, Iowa, say the 40-year-old son of an elderly couple probably killed his parents, his older sister, and her three children at a family reunion before he committed suicide. It's believed the killings took place yesterday afternoon. The bodies were found last night. Asked if the Algona slayings may have been a copycat crime of the Russellville, Arkansas shootings, officials said they're not aware of any connection. Algona had not had a homicide in at least 5 years. In Hanford, Washington today, a truck carrying low-level radioactive waste overturned. Richland, Washington Police Chief Dave Lewis says the situation is not dangerous and that none of the officers at the scene received any radiation exposure.
We had an officer and a couple of officers there initially that were right at the accident scene, and there was just nothing on them at all. So the dirt that's involved here is of extremely low radiation levels.
There were no injuries and no evacuations. The waste was being trucked to the Hanford Nuclear Reservation for disposal. Five brands of lemon-flavored cough syrup are being recalled nationwide because many of the bottles contain a potent and potentially fatal tranquilizer. A manufacturing mix-up at MYK Laboratories in Illinois caused the tranquilizer to be packaged in the cough syrup bottles. The tranquilizer is a clear liquid. The cough syrup is lemon-colored. The medicine is distributed as MyFed syrup, Lifeline TriFed syrup, Earl Unifed syrup, Walgreen Walact syrup, and Osco Ephedrid syrup. A group of Israeli army reservists say that they will refuse to serve in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. The reservists signed a petition calling the army's policy in the territories brutal suppression. At least 22 Palestinians were killed by Israeli troops during 2 weeks of anti-Israeli rioting in the territories. Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin, who is in charge of the territories, had no immediate comment on the reservists' action. People who always seem to need more time are going to get it today. But just a little bit. As Michael Richards explains, official timekeepers around the world are adding a single second to today, making it literally the longest day of the year.
The Earth is slowing down as it spins around on its axis. Since the length of the day is really a measure of how long it takes the Earth to turn completely around, that means it takes a little longer than 24 hours to complete a day. When those variations add up to a second, national timekeepers around the world agreed to add a leap second at the same moment worldwide. The official timekeeper of the U.S., Dr. Gernot Winkler of the Naval Observatory in Washington, says leap seconds may not seem like much now, but over time they add up.
In the long range, the rotation of the Earth is slowing down. Over the last 200, 300 million years, it has slowed down by several hours. And in another 300 million years from now, the day will probably be 30 hours long instead of the present 24.
The leap second was last added about 2.5 years ago. No one is sure when the next one will be, but experts expect it will be needed in the next year and a half or possibly 2 years. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards in Washington.
The dollar fell sharply today on foreign exchanges despite central bank efforts to stop its decline. The dollar was also lower against most foreign currencies on the New York Exchange. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 11 points to close the year at 1938.82. I'm Mara Liasson.
This is Fresh Air. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of the year in rock music and his picks of some of the best records of 1987.
It's a sign of the times, as Prince might say, that 1987 was the worst year for the music that I can remember. Too much time during the past 12 months was spent, I think, paying attention to established artists trying to make comebacks. Some were commercially successful, such as George Harrison's Cloud Nine, and some of them were flops, such as Mick Jagger's Primitive Cool. Some fell somewhere in between, like the first solo album by Robbie Robertson, former leader of the band. Whether they were hits in the marketplace or not, however, what all these albums shared was the fact that they were beside the point. They didn't add a thing to rock and roll discourse in 1987. And what's even more telling is that many people didn't mind that these albums were irrelevant. On some level, that was one reason they attracted so much attention. For example, it didn't matter at a certain point whether Robbie Robertson's album was good or bad. What mattered was that he'd given a dozen magazines and newspapers the same interview and was willing to rehash the history of the band once again. Above all, nostalgia pervaded 1987, and its smell did much to spoil the year. This concludes the soapbox portion of my little presentation today.
Well, I guess it would be nice.
That's George Michael's song Faith, the number one single in the country right now and one of the more pleasant surprises of the year. George Michael used to be half of the teeny bopper rock act Wham, much despised by both critics and the supposedly mature segment of the rock audience, and you can bet I include myself in both categories. But for Faith, Michael reached back to early rock, to the acoustic passion of Buddy Holly and the stripped-down blues of Elvis Presley's first recordings. The result was a big hit whose beat and rhythm had nothing in common with any of the other songs surrounding it on the charts. By contrast, a band called The Replacements was proudly, even radically, derivative on an album called Pleased to Meet Me. Drawing upon the hard rock of everyone from the Rolling Stones to T-Rex, from early Bob Seger to late Sex Pistols, The Replacements made some wild but melodic music. There were a number of big superstar releases this year, including Michael Jackson's Bad, which was inevitably an anticlimax to a career that peaked 5 years ago with Thriller. There was also The Joshua Tree by the Irish band U2. This overblown, painfully earnest record was the one that brought the group widespread fame in America. The only big star album I find myself returning to, however, is Bruce Springsteen's Tunnel of Love. I think it's Springsteen's most uneven album, but its high points, such as this song, Tougher Than the Rest, are beautiful indeed.
Well, it's Saturday night. You're all dressed up in blue. I've been watching you for a while. Maybe you've been watching me too. So somebody ran out. Left somebody's heart in a mess. Well, if you're looking for love, honey, I'm tougher than the rest.
1987 has been a dismal year for female rockers. Madonna coasted on her earlier hits, Whitney Houston's album was mediocre, and the Bangles settled in to become a novelty act. But one of the best albums of the year came from Roseanne Cash. Her album, King's Record Shop, regularly dipped into country, rock, and pop for its best effects, as on this song called The Way We Make a Broken Heart.
Just one more kiss, she'll have to miss this night with you. Now you're guilty of this secret love, as I am too. You're getting used to telling lies, feeling sorry when she cries. Now that the strings are attached, she'll catch on. We've done our part. Oh, and this is the way we make a broken heart.
Now let's return to Prince, who I think deserves a break. He presents one of the least likable personas in rock, that of a perpetually horny egomaniac, but as his double album Sign of the Times proved, he's an impressively creative horny egomaniac. No one produced a bigger, better beat in 1987 than Prince did on It, the sort of music I hope gives the Parents Music Resource Center nightmares.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. If you'd like a copy of his and our other critics' list of the 10 best of 87, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to 10 Best, Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. This is Fresh Air. Paul Grushkin collects the rock and roll ephemera that others might throw away. Grushkin is an archivist with concert promoter Bill Graham and founder of the Bay Area Music Archives. His new book, The Art of Rock, chronicles rock and roll history through the posters designed to promote rock concerts. The Art of Rock begins with the rhythm and blues posters of the 50s, moves through the psychedelic era, and ends with punk posters from the late 70s and early 80s. The book weighs in at 10 pounds and features nearly 2,000 posters laid out with accompanying text. The Art of Rock took Grushkin 4 years to complete, required some detective work, and a lot of traveling far from his home in San Francisco.
You have to go, oh boy, that person in Philadelphia's got one, and you finally meet up with that person and take a look at their collection and do a lot of photography there, and kind of as the parting afterthought, do you know anybody else in Philadelphia that has some posters? You know, I'm looking for stuff like Aretha Franklin from the early 60s or whatever. Invariably, what'll happen is that people will turn you on to other friends, because rock and roll collecting is fundamentally friends. Outside of the Hard Rock cafes, you know, who are putting tens of thousands of dollars into acquiring, you know, Beatles memorabilia and whatnot, fundamentally, rock and roll collecting is people all across the country who have this tremendous love for this stuff.
You devote a good deal of your book to posters for psychedelic bands. Do you think that poster art reached its high point then?
No question about it. Up to the point of late 1965, when so many people started to gather in San Francisco, the great poster artists, as I believe, was done by the master printers for the black acts. But it was still being done in an old-style form. However beautifully done, however beautifully crafted, it was still a style from the past. And when people started to gather in San Francisco and to really express themselves and convolute and emote and really feel themselves reach out in so many spiritual, emotional ways, artistic ways, it was no surprise that poster art came to the forefront. And therefore, you saw people like Wes Wilson, Rick Griffin, Victor Moscoso, Alton Kelly, Stanley Mouse, all collaborating together or working independently, and week after week after week, you would find a fresh new effort done. I mean, just an extraordinary time.
Do you have a sense of whose idea it was initially? Who were some of the people who had the idea of having these weekly posters and of getting independent artists to do it instead of going to a commercial house?
Well, in the early days of producing rock and roll events, Bill Graham, who had been the manager for the mime troupe, started putting on a number of benefit events. At that point, he was not powerful enough to buy display ads in the Chronicle or the Examiner, and radio certainly wasn't paying a great deal of attention. So what better way than to placard the street?
In a lot of the psychedelic posters, the image is what's really strong, and the printing that actually gives the information about the concert is sometimes pretty difficult to make out.
Yeah. Did Bill Graham has always laughed about that. He said that he would get so angry. You know, he loved the artist. He always wants to make this clear that he loved the artist. I mean, how could you not? The art was so strong, so wonderfully inventive. But, you know, the artist also got carried away, and Graham would always say, well, why don't you at least put a big old asterisk somewhere in that art so that at the bottom of the poster or on the back of the poster, it would say quite clearly who is playing this next week. But, you know, part of the charm of the psychedelic poster is that people would look at it and their body would almost start to follow the curves of the lettering. There are a lot of stories told about people looking into store windows and looking at these posters and trying to bend around and follow the curves of Grateful Dead and Quicksilver Messenger Service. And that was part of the charm of it. And it became less important almost who was playing at the bill as much as there's another incredible event taking place at the Avalon Ballroom this next week.
Is there a poster that to you is just a perfect example of that kind of poster art at its best?
Oh, no question about it. The poster that became the Grateful Dead's third album cover, known to one and all as Oxamoxowa. Rick Griffin did it for an event at the Avalon Ballroom in 1969. And what Griffin produced for them was absolutely the most brilliant piece of psychedelic art of all time. It has a tremendous technical brilliance. It has an introspection and humor. And it says, in very mysterious ways, over and over again, Grateful Dead.
You've tracked down a lot of people who have collected these posters over the years. How were they first collected? Were people ripping them off the sides of buildings where they were stapled on, getting them from proprietors? How were they first collected?
What's interesting about collecting psychedelic posters is that for the first time, and maybe ever, you had a chance to get a beautiful, unstapled poster and bring it into your home. You see, in the early days, they gave you posters at the Fillmore. Bill Graham actually presented you with a poster on your way home. It's an incredible perception, you know. He couldn't afford to do that after a while. He only gave you a handbill, maybe after 1967 or so. But in the early days, you were given this piece of art to treasure. And I think that ethic of treasuring your pieces of psychedelic art has persisted to this day. What's so interesting is when you meet up with punk and new wave collectors and how different their vision of collecting is. It's quite different than the psychedelic guys.
Yeah, how so?
Well, I had an interesting experience in going to a woman's home. She had been identified to me as one of the country's premier punk and new wave collectors. And I remember for months and months and months, I'd been dealing with people who preserved their collections, you know, in beautiful binders, you know, or framed their art, or in some way or another, the psychedelic art was a very precious commodity, something to be loved. And here I walked into her living room, and she said, oh, look at this incredible collection I got. She started ripping it apart and throwing it in the air, and I was down on my hands and knees, you know, trying to smooth out each piece of tattered paper, you know, looking for gems. Her idea of collecting art was it wasn't precious. It was street art. And she loved it, but her way of putting it together as an assemblage was to kind of maltreat it, to kind of push it around, just the way punks and new wavers were pushing the music around.
A lot of the rock art now is really produced not by individuals, but by through the record companies who hire out. So it's a much more commercial commodity than it was before? Do you think that's true?
No, actually, it's been a commercial commodity for as long as we can take it back. You have to illustrate album cover. I mean, an album cover is a physical piece of art that wraps, you know, some vinyl in a package, and that's presented to you as a consumer. And, you know, art has always been something out there to whet one's appetite, you know, to buy it off the rack and take it home. A poster, in some respects, was an extension of that.
You've been collecting rock posters and probably album jackets, too, and other rock memorabilia and ephemera for years. What I found is that there are periods when there's, say, a poster that's mass-produced, everybody has it, and it doesn't seem to have that much significance at that time. But 20 years later, after everybody's thrown theirs out, you realize how interesting it was. Now, you've been saving the stuff during the period that it's mass-produced. Did you ever wonder to yourself, is this worth saving? And have you ever been surprised at the payoffs?
You're never supposed to know at the time what it's going to be. I think that's the magic of it. Our psychedelic poster art, our rock and roll art of the 1950s, even our punk and new wave art of the 1980s, it's worth a lot because it's us. It's the story of our lives. And the fact that many, many years later it can be worth something in a commercial sense and a financial return sort of sense, well, that's wonderful. But I think that a lot of art fundamentally is traded among collectors, people who just love rock and roll and want to be turned on by, you know, other forms of it all the time.
What's something that you've preserved in the past few days? Something that you found that you thought you really should save?
Well, somebody came up to me with an incredible poster. I think it was for the Mutants. And I just fell in love with it. And I think that that's what's always going to be happening to me. I will never see the end of it.
Paul, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, it's been a great pleasure.
Paul Grushkin's new book, The Art of Rock, is published by the Abbeville Press. He spoke to us from KQED in San Francisco.
Look for a while at the child, the cat sunflower crowd, walking jingle in the midnight sun. Come, but don't mold a trample silver. Quilt starting through a dream night wind.
The Grateful Dead on Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
Any special New Year's Eve stories coming up?
Yes, we have several, and I'll tell you about a couple of them right now. Tonight, on this New Year's Eve, our All Things Considered commentators look back at their favorite year. As it turns out, I don't think for any of them it was 1987. We also talked to a rancher and writer, Linda Hasselstrom. Her memories of 1987 are tangled up with the weather. It was a wet spring, a dusty summer. Linda Hasselstrom says that in Hermosa, South Dakota, they have a special tradition for celebrating New Year's Eve. Tonight, they'll be setting off fireworks. And we take a look at Life and how Life magazine picks its pictures for the big year-end issue.
Thanks, Renee, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Stay tuned for All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has his list of the 10 best and 10 worst films of 1987. Overall, he sums it up this way.
It was the worst of years, it was the worst of years. In any decent year, only two or three of the movies I'm putting on my top 10 list would have made it. Even my choice for the best movie of the year, The Last Emperor, is terribly flawed. It has no central character, for instance, and its ostensible plot is much less interesting than the currents writhing underneath it. What was 1987 at the movies all about? Although the box office receipts broke records, there was an air of malaise and anxiety in the films themselves. They seemed to depict a world hurtling out of control. There were movies like Wall Street and The Secret of My Success, which confronted the incomprehensible juggernaut of the financial world directly. But coping with the universe of money was also the theme behind movies as diverse as Tin Men, Less Than Zero, Surrender, Working Girls, Can't Buy Me Love, The Big Easy, and House of Games. The world of sexual relations was even more out of control, and though AIDS rarely raised its ugly head, it was often what the movies we saw were secretly about. How else to explain the success of an innocuous snooze called Dirty Dancing, except that it made people powerfully nostalgic for an era when you could have sex? In the year's second biggest hit, Fatal Attraction, sex with a stranger could kill you. And that was also the message in Black Widow, Outrageous Fortune, Angel Heart, The Lost Boys, and Stakeout. The Vietnam movies that flooded the screens seemed curiously appropriate. They not only reflected a chaotic past, they reflected a chaotic, dangerous present. The jungles there mirrored the jungles we found ourselves mired in. Even the baby boom we saw on screen was out of control. People didn't have babies the normal way in movies like Raising Arizona, Three Men and a Baby, or Baby Boom. They stole them or found them or had parenthood in some way thrust upon them. Actually, the year's best movies refused to deal with these problems altogether. They escaped to the past, the future, or to some fantasy realm. For my money, the year's 10 best were: number 10, Raising Arizona; 9, Hope and Glory; 8, Tin Men; 7, Tampopo; 6, The Dead; 5, RoboCop; 4, The Stepfather; 3, Broadcast News; 2, Roxanne; and number 1, The Last Emperor. Now, before I proceed to the 10 worst movies of the year, I ought to explain something. To me, it doesn't seem worthwhile to enshrine 1987's obvious turkeys, movies like Straight to Hell and Surf Nazis Must Die and Big Bad Mama Part 2. They were plenty awful, but they fooled no one. They left no trail. No, to make it on my 10 worst list, a movie had to have pretensions and some measure of success. It had to fool a lot of the people a lot of the time. In short, it had to make a damn nuisance of itself. Here are 10 that did, counting down from the least terrible to the number 1 worst movie of the year. 10, The Secret of My Success; 9, September; 8, Ironweed; 7, The Lost Boys; 6, Less Than Zero; 5, Mannequin; 4, La Bamba; 3, Cry Freedom; 2, Beverly Hills Cop 2; and the worst movie of 1987, number 1, Fatal Attraction. Sadly, it was also the most representative. May your new year be rosier.
Hope for the best, expect the worst. Some drink champagne, some die of thirst. No way of knowing which way.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. If you'd like a copy of his and our other critics' 10 best lists, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to Fresh Air 10 Best, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. On the next Fresh Air, I'll speak with syndicated cartoonist Matt Groening. His strip, Life in Hell, appears in alternative papers across the country. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will tell us why there's no room for nostalgia in his view of rock history. And critic at large Laurie Stone will discuss the sexual politics of the film Sammy and Rosie Get Laid. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Thanks for sharing some of 1987 with us. And Happy New Year from all of us here at Fresh Air.
Ron Barron.
Lisa Bruton.
Ed Dougherty.
Leanne Hansen.
Janine Colgren-Miller.
Fred Landerl.
Joyce Lieberman.
Phyllis Myers.
Richard Parker.
Naomi Person.
Sue Spolin.
Amy Sallet.
Danny Miller.
Chris Spurgeon.
Audrey Vablitis.
And Terry Gross. We all wish you a happy and healthy 1988. This is NPR, National Public Radio.